Red Eyes Radio. I also want to say a special welcome to all new members. We bring you diverse research and opinion on a lot of different subjects. Nothing's off limits in the pursuit for truth. We urge you to do your own homework and, of course, as always, come to your own conclusions about the material that we present. RedEyesCreations.com. Go there for much more. Ian R. Crane is an ex-Oilfield executive who now lectures, writes, and broadcasts on the geopolitical webs that are being spun, with particular focus on U.S. hegemony and the New World Order agenda for control of global resources. Primarily, Ian focuses his attention and research on the geopolitical arena, but has a deep personal interest in folklore, mythology, and the cosmological belief systems of ancient and indigenous cultures. Ian returns today to discuss the elite's game plan to destroy the world's economy and the ultimate drive behind the scenes in this global game of monopoly. Welcome back, Ian. Good to have you with us again once more on Red Eyes Radio. Almost a year ago exactly since we last talked. How have you been, Ian?
Hi, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be back with you, and I really appreciate the invitation. Yeah, it's been a very, very busy year, I have to say.
And you're keeping busier still. We are going to talk about the global financial meltdown here in the first hour today. We have an exciting event set up in the UK that we're going to mention and talk a little bit more in detail about later in the program, taking place in Dublin, Manchester, and London with some interesting guests. And it's called Financial Terrorism Exposed. And I think we should lay the groundwork on this a little bit as well, Ian, because you are going to make presentations at these cities. All three of them at this stage. So let's kind of just, I guess, dive right into it here. The global financial meltdown. We have seen it. We know what's going on in a way, but it's everyone is struggling to figure out how bad is it and how quick is it going to go down the drain, Ian?
Well, those are very pertinent questions. And, you know, one of the things that I would ask people to think about is that, you know, if this was the fifth week or the fifth month of the global financial collapse, you know, the politicians and the financial community could perhaps be forgiven for not yet actually coming up with a game plan that would draw the world out of this. But we're in the fifth year. This is the fifth year of a global financial collapse. And consequently, the fact that there is no plan, either from the political arena or from the financial arena, should be your first clue that there is nothing random about this event. It is totally manipulated. And it's not really rocket science. And when I first went on record, on DVD record, that is, of saying that we were on the brink of the global financial meltdown being initiated, it was in July of 2007. And at the time, you know, I was labelled a pessimist or a doom-monger or, God forbid, a conspiracy theorist. But literally 1 month, just 1 month after I made that presentation, which came out as a DVD called Fool Me Once, and I think we're going to refer to this presentation once or twice during the course of this discussion, because I also made some other predictions during the course of that event. But 1 month after I recorded that presentation, we had the first bank collapse in the UK. This was the Northern Rock outfit. Mm-hmm. And when the Northern Rock collapsed, it was still operating within the guidelines that the financial community set itself for sort of maintaining a degree of reasonable stability in the global economy. And that guideline was that the fractional reserve ratio applied by the bank should be under 10 to 1. Well, most of the banks, ever since the 1930s, ever since the introduction of the Glass-Steagall Act, but most of the banks operated at around about 5 to 1. And that pretty much set the limits of available cash within the system, if you like.
Hmm.
Or credit within the system, probably is a better way to put it. Or debt within the system, which is probably more accurate. But the guy who was heading up Northern Rock was not a guy steeped in a financial career. He was actually a marketing guy, a guy called Adam Appleforth. And he took the decision that once he realized that the guidelines actually permitted him to sort of push above the 5-to-1 ratio, he took it to 9-to-1. So he was operating at a Northern Rock at a fractional reserve ratio of 9-to-1. But when Lehman Brothers collapsed a year later, they were operating at a fractional reserve ratio of 27-to-1.
Wow.
So, you know, what Northern Rock actually illustrated was it was actually just the thin end of a very, very large wedge. And, of course, since that time, August of 2007, you know, it was followed, of course, by the start of the collapse of the property market in the UK and then throughout the rest of Europe. It kicked off in October of 2007. So here we are, 4.5 years later, in the fifth year of a deliberately manipulated global financial collapse with no strategy whatsoever to extricate the global economy from it. And the purpose of that, Henrik, is that is the game plan. The game plan is to literally destroy the global economy. And what's occurring right now is a real-life game of global monopoly. You know, have you ever played a game of Monopoly, Henrik?
Sure have.
Have you ever finished a game of Monopoly?
I don't think so. a couple of fist fights in there occasionally, but no. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the thing, isn't it? The vast majority of people who have played Monopoly have never actually finished a game. And what tends to happen is you start sort of maybe sometime after Christmas with all the family. And, you know, after the sort of second or third afternoon of playing, it ends up like yours did with a fight. Or everyone gets bored and you simply agree to add up sort of everyone's cash and assets. And whoever's got the most is declared the winner.
Yep.
But that, of course, isn't the purpose of the game. You know, the purpose of the game is to go through to the absolute bitter end with one man standing, one person standing. And if the game actually goes right through to the bitter end, I would hazard a guess that 90%+ of the time, the last man standing is, in fact, the banker.
That's why the Parker brothers, when they invented the game, had that little J.P. Morgan, icon on the game there, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful game for sort of training, future entrepreneurs, if you like. But, of course, the purpose was to annihilate your opponents and to take possession of everything on the board.
Mm.
Well, you know, that's what's occurring right now. I mean, we're seeing it, of course, in its extreme form in Greece. I mean, Greece has been a basket case in terms of its economy for 3 years now. I mean, there's very little actually being reported on Greece in the Western media because they just don't want people to know what's happening in Greece.
Mm.
But it's a travesty.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, of course, when the economy collapsed, what did the government do? Nothing, basically, because they were told to do nothing. And then when the government finally, collapsed, was forced out of office, this is the government of, Papandreou. And, he actually had the audacity, of course, to suggest that maybe there should be a referendum on Greece's continued membership of the Eurozone.
Yeah.
Well, that, of course, was complete anathema to the financial globalists. So they made sure that Papandreou was removed from office. And he was replaced, not through an election. He was replaced by a guy who was appointed into the leadership role of the Greek nation. And this is Lucas Papademos. And Lucas Papademos was actually the head of the Greek National Bank in the years running up to Greece being admitted as a member to the EU.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it subsequently transpired that Lucas Papademos and the Greek National Bank were working in cahoots with Goldman Sachs to fiddle the books.
Yes.
So that it looked as though Greece was actually achieving all of the financial targets that had been set as criteria for it to become a candidate to join the EU. So this is literally a case of putting the crook who manipulated the figures in the first instance now in charge of the country.
Sorry to interrupt you, Goldman Sachs solely responsible for this, or can we put the blame somewhere else as well in terms of Greece?
Goldman Sachs are simply the mechanics who carry out the financial agenda on behalf of those who think they are the rightful rulers of the planet.
Right, yeah.
You know, Lloyd Blankfein, the guy has sold his soul. I mean, Lloyd Blankfein is the chief executive officer of Goldman Sachs. Is an arrogant son of a gun.
Yep.
But he's not the architect. I mean, he is simply the mechanic. He is the guy who implements the strategy as defined for him by, you know, his bosses.
Who is his bosses? I mean, he says he does God's work. I mean, is it? Go ahead.
Hey, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And you know when he made that statement? He made that statement in an interview to a Sunday Times journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And the article was published in full in the Sunday Times magazine in, I think it was late October of 2009. And in that interview, it's an incredible interview if anybody can lay their hands on it, because he actually brags about the culture of Goldman Sachs, which keeps people effectively in fear. You know, they literally had their senior executives picked up from their homes at 5 o'clock in the morning to take them to the gym, and then after the gym, they would have a light breakfast, and then all get around the conference calls for a 7:30 briefing, and then conference calls were again held late at night. To deliberately test the commitment and the loyalty of the senior players, which of course meant that they had no family life. And in fact, I think in the article, one of the wives was quoted as saying that, you know, she actually acknowledged that she had no family life at all, but the financial rewards were her compensation, which of course is a very, very sad state of affairs. Because what it's demonstrating is actually the brilliance of the construct that has been created, where people subjugate themselves to a hamster wheel, effectively.
Well, do you remember the story out of February this year? Allegedly, the new drug of choice on Wall Street is testosterone.
Yeah.
Shooting male hormone and a booster to maintain a competitive edge. That was the headline. I mean, it's just insane.
Well, of course it's insane. But, I mean, maybe we can touch on this a little bit later on. But the brilliance of the left-brain construct, you know, I mean, this is all part of what's been occurring over the last 60, 70 years. And of course, it was first alluded to in the public arena, shall I say, by Zbigniew Brzezinski in a book that he wrote in 1969, published in 1970, which pretty much went unnoticed until a few years ago. The book's called Between Two Ages, The Technotronic Era. But in that book, and I'll paraphrase, but in that book, and he was in his early 40s, I guess, at that time, but in that book he makes this observation. He says the challenge for Western governments will be to keep their people locked into consumerist materialism, preventing them from realizing who they truly are.
Hmm.
You know, that is a very, very telling observation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And of course, what we're seeing within the Goldman Sachs culture, and we're pumped full of testosterone, is the epitome of this. You know, it's built on the fears. And of course, it's one of the primal fears, which is, you know, not getting laid. not getting laid, you know, and if you want to enhance your chances of getting laid, then you've got to have the latest toys, the best and the brightest and the biggest car.
That's right.
You know, all the accoutrements, all of this meaningless add-ons to supposedly sort of boost your status within your community.
Well, exactly. What it reveals is that there's no masculinity or maleness left anymore. So they have to shoot testosterone, and then they have to define their own masculinity according to the accessories that they have on the side. Material bullshit, basically.
Well, they define their masculinity as defined by the neuroscientists who work for the ad agencies.
That's right.
You know, we've got this incredible scenario right now where all the major advertising and marketing agencies employ neuroscientists on six-figure salaries, you know, paying them more than they can earn in academia. And what they're doing is they're deliberately developing advertising campaigns, and they are targeting prepubescent teens on the basis that they believe they can create the purchasing habits of the young adult by targeting, you know, the developing brain, the temporal lobes of the developing brain.
Wow.
At a direct or a subliminal level. And, I mean, obviously they believe it works because they invest literally millions of dollars on doing exactly this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it does work, doesn't it?
Well, it does,
to a certain extent, yeah.
You know, I mean, listen, you know, there was an article I read a little while ago in one of the marketing industry's own publications, and the article was questioning the morality of a particular advertising agency who had recently won a contract to help promote the National Lottery. And the article was actually very poignant because it was making the case that a significant chunk of this advertising agency's efforts were specifically targeted at prepubescent teens. Now, you can't buy a lottery ticket until you're 18. So what the hell is a marketing company doing targeting prepubescent teens?
Yeah.
Well, of course, what they're doing is they're literally creating a construct where as soon as the youth becomes 18, that they'll rush out and spend every spare penny they've got on lottery tickets because it's the quickest way to get rich.
It's amazing. And then, exactly, so they hold it off. They promote it to those age groups, but then they hold it off and say, no, you can't buy it, which creates even more a need for it later on when they actually can do it. So it's a release there. It's just amazing. Wow.
But it's brilliant. I mean, you know, this is what we have to acknowledge. I mean, it is brilliant. But you know, at the end of the day, it's important that we actually understand it, and then we actually ultimately, of course, need to take action to prevent it happening. Because you know what we've got, particularly in the US, where it's estimated that a 16-year-old will have been exposed to over 1 million advertisements in the course of their youth, their childhood and youth. I mean, that's everything, of course. That's TV, it's radio, it's web, billboards, magazines, newspapers, radio, the whole shooting match. But, you know, that million, and of course they won't be able to remember a single one of them at a conscious level, but it's what's actually sort of getting in at the subliminal level, of course, that is of real importance.
Absolutely. Unless you want to finish, you know, something more on that point, I would want to chat back to Goldman Sachs again and ask a little bit more about
It's absolutely. I mean, it's directly linked in because, you know, the culture of Goldman Sachs is, of course, driven and partially created by these constructs that are being built by the advertising and marketing companies aimed at the youth. So that when the young traders hit the floor, they have no conscience, absolutely no conscience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the marketing industry, by self-admission, acknowledges that it lacks morality. In fact, I think it was a guy called Rory, his name comes to me, Rory Sanderson, I think his name was, but he was a former president of the Institute of Advertising and Marketing. And he acknowledged that every day questions of morality arose in advertising.
Mm.
But you know, this is what he actually said, and I quote, is very telling. He said he would rather be thought of as evil than useless. So, you know, that is in itself is indicative of the depths of depravity that, you know, this industry has sunk to in creating the model. And, of course, the absolute testosterone-driven, the epitome of this construct are those traders who go into the likes of Goldman Sachs. And, you know, we got a little bit of an insight, didn't we, earlier this year with the resignation letter of Greg Smith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, who we must assume that there were no other sort of motivation behind his resignation other than the fact that he crossed his own or been pushed across his own line in the sand. But, you know, he said that the culture there was literally to refer to clients as Muppets. And you know, what we know is that because Goldman Sachs have paid a very heavy price in fines, is that Goldman Sachs was perpetrating the globalist agenda by effectively moving wealth from effectively the middle classes into the institutions. And it was doing this by giving completely different sets of advice to individuals that had worked hard through their life and maybe accumulated a good five-figure or low six-figure or maybe even a seven-figure sum and were entrusting Goldman Sachs to nurture it for them. But what the Goldman Sachs traders were proven to have been doing was to have introduced a systemic strategy to remove the wealth from those middle-class individuals and move that money across to the establishment.
Yeah.
And this is exactly part of what we see going on right now. It's to fleece the accumulated assets of effectively everybody they possibly can and move all the wealth into the establishment, into the institutions, and, of course, to a very, very small number of people at the heart of that.
Right, right. So is that what this is about at the end of the day? Because when people see banks starting to fail, they might initially think, wow, great, you know, the bankers are failing. It's all falling apart. But isn't this about consolidation of the power that they have? They sacrifice a few of the ends here to get more power into the hands of fewer people, and Goldman Sachs seems to be at the center of that. What do you think, Ian?
I think you're absolutely right, Henrik. I think that's absolutely spot on. So that, I mean, of course, every time a bank fails, right, then all the people who had entrusted their accumulated wealth to that bank, of course, have had it wiped out. And it's all very well, you know, we hear that governments have guaranteed X amount, but of course, in the scheme of things, that's peanuts. And the reality is that governments aren't guaranteeing it at all. What's happening is future taxpayers are guaranteeing it. And so, you know, what we've seen over the last few years is this outrageous casino banking culture be developed. And you know, the bankers have, the traders in particular, have just been, like, totally irresponsible because they know it doesn't matter what the hell they do, somebody is going to take care of their debt, i.e. they're going to get a bailout.
Yep.
That bailout is going to come from a central bank. The central banks are going to get that money from governments. Governments don't have that money. So what they do is they effectively hock, they put into the pot the future assets to be gleaned from future generations. So what's going on right now with Portugal, Italy, Spain, and Greece, and of course Ireland, is that the countries are literally mortgaging, being forced to mortgage the future generations, the earnings of future generations and the tax to be paid by future generations. So basically, the next generation are being condemned to lives of absolute abject economic misery by the strategy of the bankers. Because, you know, whenever a bank is bailed out, you know, and you know, we hear all the platitudes of, oh, it's essential to keep the economy going. No, it isn't. It isn't at all. It's like any other business, you know, and the people who have invested in those banks should basically be treated as anybody who's invested in any other business. If the business goes pear-shaped and belly up, then unfortunately those people have lost out.
That's right.
But of course, in the banking industry, no, different rules apply here. And you can get a bailout. And what that bailout means is that effectively puppet governments are instructed to sell off assets within the country. And when the sale of the assets doesn't yield enough to underpin the collapsing banks, then what happens is money is loaned to the governments. So the governments borrow the money to then give to banks to help them recover from, you know, their own economic collapse. And of course, those governments have to pay back that money that's been borrowed.
Mm.
And it's the future taxpayers that are going to pay that back. So, you know, the only people who benefit from this are those individuals who are absolutely in hock with the bank.
Yeah, and the people on the boards and Goldman and other banks are recording record bonuses being handed out to these people at a time like this. It's unbelievable.
Well, and the reason they're getting record bonuses, Henrik, is exactly the same reason anybody gets a bonus from their employer. You know, bonuses aren't usually handed out on a random basis, right? The bonus strategy within the corporations is very, very clear. I mean, this is something that the compensation committees operating within the board of these companies spend many, many hours reviewing and considering. Bonus payments are offered on the basis of successful achievement of goals and objectives that are set for the period.
Hmm.
And in most cases, the period is either a calendar or a financial year. So these people are getting bonuses because they have done exactly what it was they were instructed to do, which is effectively to manage to bring about the global economic collapse and ensure that literally the banks own everything. And this is why I'm talking about the game of global monopoly. You know, Lloyd Blankfein, you know, do you have any idea, Henrik, what Lloyd Blankfein has earned over the past 5 years?
No, do we have a figure?
I can give you that figure pretty accurately.
Nice.
Right? Okay, up until, I don't know, I haven't seen, I mean, the figures for his earnings in 2011 should be published by now, but I must confess I haven't actually caught up with them. So up until the end of 2010, so 2007, 8, 9, and 10, 4 years, those 4 years were the period that the world was going to hell in a handcart, being manipulated, being certainly driven by the Goldman Sachs mechanics. Lloyd Blankfein in that period earned £157 million.
Wow.
Now his base salary is $1.1 million. Sorry, I should have said dollars. I think I said pounds.
Yeah,
$157
Okay, well, that's still a lot. That's still a shitload of money. Yeah.
It's just shy, at current exchange rates, it's just shy of £100 million.
Mm. And then $40 million per year, approximately, then, above that.
Well, and the thing is that, let's say, his base salary is $1.1 million. So the bulk of his income comes from performance bonus, payments into his pension plan, which are linked to performance, and stock options.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, this is just completely and utterly outrageous. Now, what happened in 2008, he actually only got his base salary. And I tell you why that happened, because what happens in the corporations, when the boards realize that if they start paying massive bonuses, there might be a bit of a reaction. Now they don't give a damn.
Yeah.
But back in 2008, this was the first year, the first full year of the global financial collapse. And so the board of Goldman Sachs, in my opinion, recognized that it wouldn't be necessarily astute to be paying out large bonuses. So they basically said, you know, most people are just going to have to take their base salary. But all they did was defer it. Because of the 157 million that Blank Fiend has earned over the past 4 years, 64 million of that was from 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what happened is that all the bonuses and that weren't paid in 2008 were simply deferred for 12 months and pushed back into 2009.
I see. Yeah.
And of course this is how, you know, they conceal it from you know, the shareholders. But I mean, it's just outrageous. I mean, we're talking numbers here that are an obscenity.
So what is, okay, this is very interesting. What does that money buy you? I mean, effectively, are we talking about these people now running the show with their money? I mean, paying people off, getting people into positions to be able to continue this, or is there somebody else behind the scenes that says, job well done, you know, Blank Fiend and everyone else there, here's your bonus for what you're doing? Is that what's happening, do you think?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. I mean, that's absolutely the case. Like I said, and I've said many, many times over the years, anybody whose name is in the public domain is not one of the Inner Sanctum. I mean, the people who are in the public domain, I mean, the Bushes, the Blairs, the Camerons, the Obamas, the Cheneys, the Rumsfelds, the Panadas, all of these people, these are not the Inner Sanctum. I mean, probably the closest people to the Inner Sanctum are the likes of Brzezinski and Kissinger, who are the arch strategists. I mean, these are the late 20th, early 21st century versions of Bernard Baruch from the early part of the 20th century.
Mm.
But even so, these guys are not actually part of the Inner Sanctum. They are trusted. But having said that, I will also share with you, Henrik, it is my opinion that they are also despised.
Yeah.
They are trusted because they have proven their loyalty, but they are despised because those who are amongst the Inner Sanctum, those who do believe that they are the rightful rulers of the planet, know that these individuals have sold their own soul, and in many cases the souls of their nations, in return for material wealth.
Hmm. So are you saying that that's not the primary drive behind the scenes then?
No. I mean, the ultimate drive behind the scenes is total global dominion. And that's their goal. It's total ownership of everything. Total control of everyone.
So the money is just a means to this end for them, basically. They're using the system as it exists currently to be able to steer. See, this is what I've been thinking about, too, that the reasoning here, the reason why it's been allowed to run amok and turned into a casino with the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, as you mentioned before, is because someone is interested in destroying the last tiny few little vestiges of the so-called free market capitalist system. This is to say, look at what happens when we have this kind of system. We can't have this anymore. We need a new direction for the, you know, the world currency, world global bank, you know, more control, legislation, rules, this is going to be an incredible stranglehold on the little guy at the end of the day. What do you think, Ian?
I think you're absolutely right. And, I mean, that's exactly the reason that, you know, we're not reading anything about what's happened in Iceland. Now, admittedly, you know, it's a lot easier to resist the overtures, if you like, of the globalists, the socio-psychopathic corporate globalists, when you are a relatively small, isolated nation. And of 300,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, you've got to start somewhere. And so if we look at the model, and it is my opinion that Iceland was intended to be a practice run. It was intended to be like fine-tuning the template for the total annihilation of a nation's economy. And of course, the Icelandic economy had been like on acid for about 7 years. Of course, the great irony is that Iceland really has no history of international finance. And then this nation of deep-sea fishermen suddenly found that there were sort of easier ways to make their money than spending weeks in 30-foot seas.
Hmm.
And I'm making light of it, but it's not too far away from what actually happened.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's not a nation that is particularly well-versed in international finance. But what they did find is that, if you like, they got as far as 101 in a period when you know, there was the deliberate intent to bring about, or to set the scene to bring about, the collapse of the global economy by pumping all of this fiat credit into the system. In other words, getting individuals, companies, governments into such massive debt that the bankers could then sort of wade in and you know, call in all of the debts.
Basically, now, take everything over, take over the real stuff that they do have in the country. This even includes the sources of you know, the hot water springs and stuff like that. They wanted to develop this incredibly much, and foreign companies, as far as I understood the situation, came in there and tried to take things over. But what happened?
I think the ultimate catalyst, the ultimate, because Iceland's a relatively small economy, obviously, the ultimate catalyst, I think, was Alcoa. I think it was the aluminium company who set about building a hydroelectric plant that would have had the capability and capacity to generate, like, many times over what Iceland needed. But, of course, the cost of the project was going to be borne by the Icelandic people. Well, you know, what happened actually shocked and rocked the globalists, because when the economy collapsed at the back end of 2008, it was total. I mean, it was absolutely total. What's really interesting is that the chief executive officer of Danske Bank had been over to Iceland about a year previously to try and encourage a greater degree of conservatism, because his observation was that the model being adopted by the Icelandic bankers was just not sustainable, and it was potentially going to bring down their national economy. And the guy was actually booed off stage and effectively forced to leave the country. But, of course, what he had to share with them was incredibly prescient, because barely a year later, that's exactly what occurred. Well, the government really had no clue. And so they holed themselves up in the government buildings in Reykjavik. And then it was the women of the country. It was the women of the country who hit the streets in Reykjavik. Now, the sort of government and finance district in Reykjavik isn't exactly that large. But they hit the streets, and they went down there every day and beat their pots and pans. And actually became known as the Pots and Pans Revolution. Well, when the government finally realized that it had just totally lost all the confidence of the people, it resigned. When they had the election, something very interesting happened, because a lot of the established MPs, not all, but a significant number, were not returned, and no political party actually had a majority, because a lot of independents had been returned, and many of them were women. And so women actually dominated the new Icelandic parliament. And the attitude in Iceland was very interesting. I mean, it was basically this. You know, the men fucked it up, and it's the women that are going to have to put it right. And you know what? I mean, that sounds a bit glib, but there's actually a lot of truth in it. Because the women were not in any way, shape, or form linked to the establishment. There wasn't even the old school tie network. So when the IMF came in and made overtures to the new government and said, "We're here to help," basically the newly elected Icelandic government basically turned around and said, "Why on earth would we ever turn to an organization that was supposedly in position to prevent this from happening?" And yet you did nothing. You stood back, and one might even argue that you encouraged it. So, no, we're going to do it without you. Thank you very much. Well, this was a bit of a sort of a shock to Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who was still in the chair at the time, and some of his henchmen. But they had no choice, to basically just sit back. And, I mean, the Russians offered Iceland the services of some of their top economists. And they did it on the basis, they said, "Look, you know, we know what the IMF are like because they tried to do it with us." Which was, of course, exactly the strategy that the IMF and World Banks had applied during the Yeltsin years. And it was only when Putin came into office and implemented his strategy with the seven ugly sisters, the seven oligarchs, and then effectively using the resources of the country to get the global financiers out. So they were paid off, and basically today, obviously, Russia is an independent, sovereign economy.
Hmm.
It's one of a very small number.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, what has happened over the last few years is that effectively Iceland has literally built an economy from the ground up. It is not in hock with a Rothschild central bank. It's effectively established its own people's banking system. So when money is put into the economy in Iceland and is loaned into the economy, the interest that is ultimately paid back doesn't go to a private banker. It comes back to the people of the country,
mm.
you know, to be used again. I mean, this is exactly the model now that needs to be introduced in Greece, in Spain, in Italy, in Ireland, and ultimately, of course, elsewhere. You know, the days of the private banking system is coming to an end. The only question is when. Right now, they're fighting a rearguard action because the reality is the magnitude of their criminal activity is becoming so increasingly apparent that the financial illiteracy of politicians is no longer going to be a defense for them. So they've either got to get up to speed and start understanding what's going on, because more and more people in the street, you know, Joe Public is starting to take an interest in global finance. They are starting to understand the massive fraud of the fractional reserve banking system. And like I said, it is literally a question of when. I think the rearguard action is such that, you know, it may all be over by the shouting as soon as the end of this year. You know, well, I think that I think in October, and I mean, this isn't rocket science. It's just a case that almost every other global financial collapse has occurred in mid-October. But so let me give myself a bit of a window. The period between mid-September and mid-November is one of highest risk. And it is my opinion that unless people actually start to understand and comprehend the magnitude of the fraud that's being perpetrated, the savings of millions of people is going to literally vanish within the next few months.
Hmm.
So, I mean, and that is the primary driver of why I've put on these three events in Dublin, Manchester, and London, called Financial Terrorism Exposed, with John Perkins headlining the events, because John Perkins, of course, is the only person, as far as I'm aware, still alive, who has actually worked for an organisation that was effectively a front company for the World Bank / IMF, and his job was to deliberately get nations into debt. And he knew that if he wasn't successful in persuading those national leaders to buy into his proposed infrastructure projects, then the next stage of the game would be for those leaders to be assassinated. And they were normally assassinated by being in a plane crash. And if that wasn't successful, then basically a manipulated military coup, i.e. driven normally by the CIA / Mossad / MI6. Now, John Perkins, this is the first time he's spoken in the UK and Ireland. But let me just read you the opening paragraph in his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Mm-hmm.
Because this, in just this short paragraph, it epitomizes everything that we've been talking about just now. He says, economic hitmen are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know, I was an economic hitman.
There you go.
Now, and he wrote this book, I mean, he published this book in, I think, in 2006. I mean, he actually started to write it, I think, about 20 years previously.
Right, yeah.
Perhaps thought better of actually putting it into the public domain. But he actually goes on in the opening, on the opening page of the book. He says, he wrote in 1982, as the beginning of a book with the working title, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, the book was dedicated to the presidents of two countries, men who had been my clients, John Perkins' clients, whom I respected and thought of as kindred spirits, Jaime Roldos, president of Ecuador, and Omar Torrijos, president of Panama. Both had just died in fiery crashes. Their deaths were not accidental. They were assassinated because they opposed that fraternity of corporate government and banking heads whose goal is global empire. We economic hitmen failed to bring Roldos and Torrijos around, and the other type of hitmen, the CIA-sanctioned jackals, who were always right behind us, stepped in.
That's right, jackals. I remember that we had John Perkins with us on the program. We talked about that quite extensively. It's a very fascinating story that he shares, and he's written a couple of books consequently, I believe, as well. So
he has indeed. I mean, basically, he's written, he wrote The Secret History of American Empire, and the subtitle of that is The Truth About Economic Hitmen, Jackals, and How to Change the World.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he actually moves into some constructive proposition. And then his more recent book, which has not been published in Europe. You can get it from Amazon, but it hasn't been published by any European publisher. And this is a book that he wrote after going over to Iceland in the immediate aftermath of their collapse. And of course, you know, he realized immediately what had occurred. And he wrote the book Hoodwinked. And basically this is ostensibly looking at what occurred in Iceland and a proposition as to how Iceland could get out of it. And it was because of that book that the Icelandic government effectively invited him to work with them as a sort of informal consultant.
Hmm.
So he has certainly had a role to play, however minor or major, I'm not sure, but he certainly had a role to play in helping the Icelandic government establish their new economy out of the clutches of the central banks. And that's why his presentation in Ireland on Sunday, May the 27th, is so, so, so important, because it is 5 days before the Irish have a referendum. And this is actually the fourth referendum that they've had in the past, what would it be, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Each time, of course, the referendum has been called, because each time the Irish government have effectively been forced to hand over more and more sovereign power to a foreign entity. And in the Irish constitution, there is a requirement that any time a government wants to hand power over to a foreign entity, they have to hold a referendum.
So it's more obvious in Ireland, obviously because of this reason, than in other countries, meaning this has already happened in the other European countries. But in Ireland, we get a chance to actually see it because they have to vote on it, correct?
Well, exactly. But, I mean, of course, the information that's put out to the people is
oh, that's all backwards.
Massive obfuscation.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, you know, the document that's been put through people's doors is absolutely incomprehensible gobbledygook, which nobody can read. But, of course, nobody can deny that they haven't had something from the government telling them about the European Stability Mechanism.
Hmm.
But, of course, the reality is that it's nothing to do with European stability. It's literally about European debt, bringing about the collapse of a sovereign nation and subjugating the people of that nation for generations to come to lives of absolute, abject economic misery. So
what is it that they can do? If you recall a number, please give us that. They can call on, what was it, 70 billion euros from was it each country or collectively on, like, what, a 7 days notice or something like this?
Exactly. I mean, the European Central Bank, I mean, look how brilliantly they have executed their master plan. The euro is 11 years old. You know, not 11 centuries, it's 11, 11 years, not even 11 decades. And the euro was established when, obviously, in 2001. In 2000, the Rothschilds effectively instructed almost all of the EU member nations to sell a significant chunk of their gold holdings to the Rothschilds to enable them to establish the sort of base funding for the European Central Bank.
Wow. Yeah.
In the UK, what that equated to was Gordon Brown being instructed to sell 400 tons of the UK's 715-ton gold reserves. And, of course, it was sold when the price of gold was $250 an ounce. I mean, the price of gold went up to $1,900 last July.
Wow,
you know, right now it's taken a bit of a dip for a number of reasons. But it went up to $1,900 last July. Gordon Brown had sold the 400 tons at $250 an ounce. So the Rothschilds, in establishing the European Central Bank, already took a significant chunk of the real wealth from the nations by taking that gold. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would have been, you know, it would have been far more sensible to say, or for Gordon Brown to say, well, okay, you know, just stick it on the ledger. we'll hold on the gold, but just put on the ledger that we owe you the equivalent of whatever 400 times $250 is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or 400 million. Yeah, you got it? So, you know, we'll keep the base asset. We'll keep the gold. But no, they transferred the physical gold.
And why is that? Why do they want the actual gold, do you think?
Well, because they want to strip. They want to literally asset strip the sovereign nations. So that once again, I mean, like Greece, I mean, the deal that has been forced upon the unelected Greek government is not only have they had to sign over a significant chunk of their national assets, a significant chunk of future tax income, but they have also had to sign an agreement to state that they will not seek any money from any other source. So in other words, they can't go to the Russians or the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
If they come up with a better deal, they've got to go back to the European Central Bank and the IMF.
Talking about painting yourself into a corner. Great.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And of course, the vast majority of people, Henrik, you know, they're not going to know this, because even if they have the inclination, you know, they just don't have the time. You know, people right now are increasingly spending every damn hour under the sun to keep a roof over their head and food on the table and keep the loan sharks from the doors.
Yeah,
yeah, and we're getting ourselves, of course, into a financial abyss. And it is not, the issue is that the problems are not going to be resolved by just doing more of the same. You know, that's why the global financiers are so desperate to keep what's occurred in Iceland away from the masses on the mainland of Europe. You know, and don't be surprised, by the way, Henrik, don't be at all surprised if in a couple of years you start to read in the media that Iceland is thought to have a program of weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, that would be interesting to watch that. Now, this is a very interesting kind of dichotomy here, because we have from other sources as well and expressed concern also about, well, effectively socializing banks, if that's what we can call it. You know, in the beginning, people might be running, you know, the bank in that sense, but depending on the politicians and the party in power, could this also to some extent be a dangerous move? Now, I'm not saying that the private route is any better, but is there any legitimate criticism of a system like that, do you think?
Oh, potentially, of course. I mean, there is no question that ultimately, any kind of system relies on the integrity of the individuals running it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, of that, there is absolutely no doubt.
And it's the people's job to keep those power, keep the people who are having this, well, maybe not power is even not the right word, really, but the responsibility of maintaining the system. We can't just hand it over to somebody and expect them to do a good job and then stick our heads in the sand. We have to be aware and realize who we put in charge. That's the point there.
I think that's a great observation. And you know, I think one of the things that is happening right now is that more and more people, I mean, I'm not talking about everybody on the streets, but more and more people are starting to understand how this existing system, how this fraudulent fractional reserve system actually works. Now, it may, in the scheme of things, be, you know, a relatively small percentage, But compared to, say, a decade ago, it's enormous. It's absolutely enormous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we can have discussions today. I mean, I've just finished a tour, a series of, I think it was 19 workshops around the UK since the end of the second half of February. And I've conducted these workshops in cities from Aberdeen right down to Exeter in the southwest. I think it's over 800 people now have been through these workshops from all walks of life, all age groups represented. And the sort of discussion that we're having right now, you could have with a significant chunk of the people mm-hmm. attending those workshops.
Yeah.
That would not have been possible probably even 4 years ago, let alone 10 years ago.
That's very encouraging. This is very interesting, and we can go on and on here about, and we should. We're going to continue the next segment to talk more about this, but I do want to squeeze in here before we take a break for the first hour to talk a little bit more about the conference that's upcoming. We've talked a little bit about John Perkins, obviously. I want you to mention some of the other names that's
yep.
coming. Give us the dates and the times and whatever you want to do, their websites, and, of course, you know, how to get tickets and things like that as well.
Okay, well, there's one website for all the events, and the website is www.economichitman, or one word, economichitman.co.uk. And there you'll find all the information for the Dublin, Manchester, and London events. The Dublin event is at the Stillorgan Park Hotel on the outskirts of Dublin, and that's on Sunday the 27th of May. All the events start at 1 o'clock, and the purpose of that is so that people can actually get up at a sensible hour and travel to the event. Doors will open at noon, but the events will start at 1, and they will go right through until about 9:30 in the evening. So John Perkins is in Dublin. He's joined in Dublin by Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert.
Mm, really good, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, Max has, again, contributed very significantly with his programs on Russia Today to educating, you know, a very wide audience on the fraudulent banking system. They're joined by William Engdahl. William Engdahl, of course, an outstanding economist. And although he's written some excellent books over the last decade, Seeds of Destruction
yes,
is probably one
right.
of his better-known books,
yeah, yeah.
which he wrote about the GM industry. And he wrote a book, I think he published it about 2 years ago now, called Gods of Money,
mm-hmm, yeah.
which is, once again, an outstanding analysis of you know, the global financial collapse. Then we are in Dublin, we have Thomas Sheridan, who has written some outstanding, two books now, outstanding books on sociopaths, how to spot sociopaths and psychopaths, you know, in our community or in industry, in business. And, of course, he asked the question, you know, whether they're born or trained or combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I think that, you know, what is happening right now is that more and more people are starting to be able to, how should I say, resonate with others. And if the resonance isn't there, then, you know, they're actually walking in the other direction. It's almost like humanity's polarizing to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then finally, myself. I think we're also going to be joined by a political commentator, and I think Anthony Cochrane in Dublin. But it's going to be an amazing event. I mean, we are hoping that we have 300 plus people there. So far, we've sold well over 100 tickets for the event. We are holding some tickets back. So that there are some for those who do just decide to come along on the day. But the important thing here is to send a massive message, because we have invited all of the Irish media. Will they turn up? Most likely not.
Mm.
But the important thing is that more and more people, of course, are not relying on the mainstream media. They are getting their information from elsewhere. So the Dublin event has been supported by the Awaken Ireland group, the One World Scam group, and these groups are doing tremendous social networking in raising awareness of what's actually going on. And, you know, if we can make a small contribution towards getting a no vote in the referendum on Thursday, May 31st, then, you know, I'll sleep easy that night.
Well, we should try everything we can. Why not? You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then the following weekend, so it's after the referendum, the following weekend, the tour moves to Manchester. And then we're at the Middleton Arena, which is just to the north of Manchester. And then the following day, on Sunday, the 3rd of June, we're down in London. And the event was originally going to be staged at the Radisson Blu Hotel in Portman Square. But we eventually decided that we'd move just around the corner, so it's only a few hundred yards away, to the Marble Arch Thistle Hotel. So it's right in the heart of London, about 150 metres from Marble Arch Station. And once again, both those events, they start at 1 o'clock, run through to 9.30. At the London event, we're going to be joined as well by Brian Gerrish of the UK Column. And the UK Column, by the way, have also been tremendously supportive in terms of the organisation of the London event. And the Manchester event is being organised in conjunction with the ICANN Planet group. So, you know, these are groups that have all emerged over the last few years, and in their own unique ways, they're helping to spread the word and you know, make people aware of what's actually occurring, and try and get them to actually think for themselves.
That's right. Very important and very good. We have well, as this program goes up, if you tune in as it goes up, same day on the website, you have about a week there until the event in Dublin. So if you're close and want to head over there from other places, you have still time to do so. And again, the website there, economichitman.co.uk. And I also want to mention your website. You got a new one, though. You have, or working on a new one, right? IanCrane.com.
Ian R. Crane. Ian R. Crane. It has to be Ian R. Crane, because there's another Ian Crane who's an estate agent in Liverpool.
Yeah, okay.
And there's another Ian Crane who actually is a public speaker on a completely different subject over in Suffolk. So the R is simply, it is my middle initial, but it's to differentiate myself from the other Ian Cranes. So it's IanRCrane.com.
There we go. Really good. We're going to have these links up as well.
So, Henrik, let me just also mention that I'm now the publisher of two new magazines in Europe. I don't produce the magazines. I don't edit the magazines. They are both edited in New Zealand, interestingly. And I came across them when I was touring Australia and New Zealand last year. And I was so impressed that I made an arrangement with the editor and the owner of the magazines to bring them to Europe. So, although it's now, we've just released issue 27 of Uncensored magazine. The website is www.uncensoredmag.co.uk. Unfortunately, at the moment, these magazines are only available by subscription, but you can get a one-off copy, or you can purchase an annual subscription. And they come out, it comes out quarterly. It's 100 pages in full color. It's an absolutely outstanding a piece of work, and I can say that because it's not produced by me.
that's really good in full color and everything, huh? Wow.
Yeah, oh, it's absolutely. It's just, mm-hmm. And it's just, if you get order it online, a single issue is $7.99, including postage, or $29.99 if you want the full year's subscription, including postage. And then there's a euro rate for shipping to other European countries. Now, the other magazine comes out sort of 6 weeks from Uncensored, and that's the New Zealand Journal of Natural Medicine. And this is absolutely the publication that Big Pharma do not want you to read.
And it's based in New Zealand for a reason, I reckon, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. With everything that's going on in the EU right now, with the legislation that was introduced last year, of course, the Traditional Herbal Medicines Products Directive, which effectively requires all herbal and natural products to be removed from the shelves throughout the EU by April 30th next year, unless they have been approved. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, this is the publication that you know, you will need if you want to stay free from Big Pharma.
And what is there a specific website again for that?
There is, and the website for this one is nznaturalmed.co.uk. All one word, nznaturalmed.co.uk. And it's exactly the same price, same subscription, same quality, 100 pages, full color, very little advertising. The real focus is on information.
All right, really good. I'm going to give you the URLs there again so you can head to the websites and take a look. Uncensoredmag.co.uk and nznaturalmed.co.uk. We will have these linked up as well. We're going to continue talking more, but do check out the conference, of course, again, if you're close around the area or have the capacity, means, and time and everything else to fly over there and have a look. I think it'll be really good. So thank you for this, Ian. We'll talk more after the break, so stay with us. In the Members Hour, Ian discusses the phenomenal acceleration into global governance unfolding this year. He'll talk about preparing for the unexpected and limiting damage. Then he talks about the Illuminati Game Cards, a standalone card game made by Steve Jackson, inspired by Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea. The game has ominous secret societies competing with each other to control the world through sinister means, and the odd thing is that the cards seem to be prophetic. Later, Ian talks about the insane militarization of London for the 2012 Olympics. 49,000 troops will be present in London. Ian shares some interesting possible scenarios that could unfold during the Olympics, from false flag terrorism to a fake alien event. Don't miss this or any of our previous programs. Subscribe and get full access to all past and upcoming programs. It's simple, quick. For more information, head on over to redicecreations.com. Next on Red Ice Radio, we have Tom Horn on Petrus Romanus, the prophecy of the final pope. Then we have Dean Clifford, John B. Wells, Neil Kramer, Richard Merrick, Nora Gadgaudas, Britt D. and Tom Secker, Richard Grove, Winter Lake, Alex Newman, Peter Halderson, Eric Karlström, Denise Barcelo, Drunvalo Melchizedek, and Jordan Maxwell are all coming on the program. You're welcome to tune in again, but we'll be right back the second hour with Ian Crane up next.